you have endured unto the end. What can I more say? I would like to say that it's been an enjoyable week. And Chuck just signaled to me that he's got two books left. And don't go home without one. He said he'd even sign it as a memento of this school. Now remember, don't disappoint Chuck. We said at the beginning that we hope to say something to you in this last class that might make you fully aware of the uniqueness of the position that we have as believers in those precious things of the gospel. That gospel message that Paul preached in the words that he used when he said that Christ must needs have suffered. Just for the sake of review, we gave you those six categories of the reasons why he must have suffered, must needs have suffered. We asked you a few questions during this week to try and direct your minds to certain areas of the scriptures, those that related to those things that pertain to Abraham and the demand that was made of God at the test of him. We also directed your attention to the reason why Moses would know that he was to be a leader, to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt. And yesterday we asked you that question, whether or not the offering or the killing of Achan represented an offering of human flesh to appease an angry God. Leading you to this hour, it all began, this thought of mine, when I began to consider the demand that was made of God to Abraham. You see, when God said to Abraham, take out your son and there offer him at a place that I will show you as a burnt offering, there is no indication that Abraham said to God, why should I offer my son, a member of the human race, and particularly this lad that you have said is to be the means by which the covenant that you have made to me is to be fulfilled? He never questioned human sacrifice. Well, why? And this was the puzzle that bothered me. Why didn't he question it? I spoke to Florence Ray at our gathering, and I said, is there any indication that you know of, or where could I go to find out, when human sacrifice began in the history of men? And she suggested perhaps that I go to some encyclopedias, particularly in those areas that had to do with archaeology. I also spoke to Martha Gett. I don't know whether you, any of you know her. She also is a librarian in Toronto, and she suggested, much as did Florence Ray. Well, I thought, well, I guess I'm going to have to do it on my own. They're not going to do it for me. So I went to the library in Hamilton, and I found this book that I had made reference to you earlier in the week about human sacrifice, and it was written by Nigel Davis, or Davies. I'm going to quote a little bit out of this here this morning. Not that I'm quoting this as gospel, but simply to make you aware of a point. You see, the emphasis that we have been placing this week on these things that Christ must needs have suffered demanded that he, as a member of the human race, be sacrificed. And to me, this didn't seem, as it were, or you shouldn't say to me, rephrase that. To many who look at the scriptures, this is considered completely inconsistent to the demands that the God of the Bible made of the nation of Israel when he instructed them, in particularly in relation to such areas as Topheth. And those of you who know what Topheth is will see the comparison. God forbade human sacrifice and condemned the nations around Israel for engaging in this practice. And yet, he turned around and sacrificed his son, a member of the human race. Now, what is the justification? So, back to the original question. Why didn't Abraham question? Well, Abraham had been conditioned to human sacrifice. Where did Abraham come from? Ur of the Chaldees. And this archaeologist, Woolley, is that his name? Okay. In his excavations at Ur, found out that the taking of human life in sacrifice was not unusual. In fact, the anthropologist, and I understand that that discipline means the study of people, their origins, their practices, and their where they stand in the society of which they were members. Anthropologists tell us that the act of killing humans dates back to the Neanderthal man. And of course they say that was roughly 20,000 years ago. And of course they zap these remains with the various ways they use to test the carbon, and therefore they determine it's 20,000 years ago. You know there is a flaw in that kind of testing, as is pointed out in the book of Genesis flood, that the carbon dating system is totally dependent upon the loss of the particles relating to carbon, that this loss has always been consistent as it is in this time. They don't know what happened 5,000 years ago, whether or not carbon was losing its strength, if I can use it that way. I'm not describing it correctly in the scientific terms, but the dating is under serious questioning. And therefore, to say that the Neanderthal man who was engaged in human sacrifice 20,000 years ago was fact, it may not be correct, but is not correct. The point, though, they make is that in the excavations, they've often found skulls. They were a collector of skulls. And so the conclusion they come to is that these things were venerated for certain reason, either as members of the family and were kept as relics around the house to remind them of their ancestors and what they accomplished. But in the case of those that were Abraham had come from, at the death of a king or some great person, as many as, well, the number would range from 6 to 80 people were buried with him. And all these people were killed that they might accompany this person into the nether world, as they felt. They were killed in the case of, well, it was probably voluntarily, a voluntary death on their part, because they took of narcotics which brought about their death. And in excavating these people, they found as many as 80 people entombed with one man who had died. So Abraham, coming out of this culture, was aware that human sacrifice, which it would be in the case of one person dying and 80 others dying with him, was not uncommon. Well, when you begin to expand in this work of the anthropologist, you find out that human sacrifice was prevalent throughout the whole of the world, virtually. In Africa, human sacrifice was a common practice. The Maoris of the Polynesian Islands were all also people who sacrificed humans. The North American Indian, the people of the Scandinavians, all these people did it. The Chinese. In fact, it wasn't uncommon, not only at the time of a death of a great person, for others to be entombed with them, but to get on the right side of the various pagan gods, human sacrifice was made. To appease the god, to solicit better crops, to solicit fertility in the family, all these things which were of a benefit to the members of these various cults, human beings were sacrificed that they might achieve these desires. In fact, in excavating in many areas, the archaeologists have found that human beings have been entombed in the foundations of many buildings. Now, what does that remind you of? You remember when Moses subdued the city of Joshua subdued the city of Jericho, thank you. He said that cursed is he that builds this city, because he will do it. And let's just look at this, where he said it, in Joshua 6 and 26. Joshua adjured them at that time, saying, "Cursed be the man before the Lord that riseth up and buildeth this city Jericho. He shall lay the foundation thereof in his firstborn, and his youngest son he shall set up the gates." Turn with me to 1 Kings 16. In his days did Hiel the Bethlehemite build Jericho, and he laid the foundation thereof in Abram his firstborn, and set up the gate thereof in his youngest son Segub, according to the word of the Lord which he spake by Joshua the son of Nun. So the archaeologists and the anthropologists look at the Bible and they say, yes, you know, the cults that these other people had are exactly what the Israelites had. You know, this thing of using children and humans in the foundation of a building was supposed to give the occupants of the building protection by the spirits of those that were entombed in its foundation. This practice was so bad in China that if a new building was going up or if a new bridge was being built, mothers never let the children out of their sight. They just kept the close attention to them so that they would not end up in the foundation of these buildings. Now, You see how similar this situation is here in the Bible to what we're suggesting in other areas?
You know, I can't give you the condensation of this work in a few minutes without leaving out 99% of it. But the writer points out that one of the other practices that was common among these original peoples was that in the offering of the sacrifice to curry the favor of the various gods to whom it was being offered, the sacrifice was made, and in many ways it was mutilated, abused. I'm talking about the offering, the sacrifice itself, and the people participated in it, and they certainly witnessed it, and in many cases they partook of the flesh of the sacrifice. They may always, many of the, I believe it was the Incas in South America, where this sacrifice, these kinds of human sacrifices were made, and certainly in Central Africa, it was a common thing. And each case where these sacrifices were made, there was a ritual involved. It just wasn't taking an individual and slaughtering them, but they went through various stages in the offering of this individual. They were done by prescribed ritualistic formulas. Now, back to the question that was whizzing around in my mind. Back to Abraham. Why he didn't question it? Because he'd been exposed to it. So then you begin to come to the matter of Jesus' sacrifice. I don't know if you can read that. Somebody loaned me a pen earlier, and I couldn't find it. I'd left it up here. I did it with my red one, and therefore it's not as clear. Now, in Jesus' sacrifice, which, as we labored earlier in the week, and so have the other teachers, was a member of the human race. Now, what did we say about his sacrifice? He was a member of the human race, okay? We said that he was specially prepared, and it was mentioned by Blair this morning. His case, he was washed, has been demonstrated by his baptism by John. He was bruised.
Of course, we've made reference inferentially
to the 53rd of Isaiah, but we didn't read it fully. He was cut. His flesh was broken. He was a prisoner. His blood was spilled. And the purpose of his sacrifice? We listed it here, didn't we? Purpose was to cleanse the people, please the Father, and to do His will. Now these are exactly the same reasons that Aboriginal peoples make sacrifice. I failed to tell you that most of the sacrifices that were made, other than those that we inferred to in the case of the family of the retinue of the great man, were usually prisoners. And many of them were kept for prolonged periods, fattened up, and dressed up in the best clothes, and then they were taken. And one of the common denominators between almost all these acts of sacrifice that are being made by these people was the washing. Now, when you consider those things, you can see, in our understanding of the Scriptures, how that people would say, really, this sacrifice of Christ isn't that great deal different than what was practiced by Aborigines. So how do we, as convicted members of the Christadelphian body, defend that kind of an accusation? In fact, they even go one step further. I said earlier that we witnessed
in the accounts of these scriptures, or at least this book by Davies, that the people partook of the sacrifice. What is our memorial service? They cite our memorial service to say, well, look, you're also partaking of, in type, the sacrifice of Jesus, or the body of the sacrifice victim. In fact, one of the church groups, and you well know, practiced what is known as, or at least believed, that by the ritualistic movements of the priest, the wafer and the wine are turned to literal blood and flesh. Now, in the face of these kinds of accusations that Christianity is no different than pagan worship, we are called upon to make defense of our position. How do we explain the difference that this sacrifice that was made by God in the preparation of His Son for the propitiation of all mankind, how do we defend it? Well, we defend it very easily. I would also like to stop here for a moment and suggest that the condemnation in the scriptures, where God roundly condemned the nation of Israel for engaging in human sacrifice, which they did in the Valley of Topheth, you can read of it in Jeremiah 7:31-32, you can read of it in 2 Kings 23:10. Why did he roundly condemn it? Because it was a pagan practice, and it was based on pagan ideas, and the principle for which they were offered was entirely different than the principle for which this was done, the sacrifice of Christ. At the bottom, I have written that this was done because of God's will. Now, what's the difference? Well, I want to tell you as a group that our position is both credible and believable and provable that this is the will and purpose of God. These other ideas, and I'll even go so far as to suggest how they came about. I think they were somewhat evolved from the thinking of men. And why is there this sort of common denominator between them, or similarity would be a better way of putting it? Well, where did all mankind come from? The sons of Noah. What about the sons of Noah? Did they know anything about sacrifice? Well, certainly they did. They witnessed Noah's sacrifice when he came out of the ark. They had been instructed by what they had been taught by Noah of those things that took place before, back to the time of Cain and Abel and so on. They were aware that sacrifice was necessary and that blood had to be shed. They had an awareness of this. And so when the tongues were confused at the time of Babel, these people that dispersed to the four directions of the compass carried with them the idea that blood must be shed for the remission. But in the evolution or the involvement of time, the thinking of man probably got to the point that if animals were good sacrifices, humans would probably be better. And so, over years, this idea was developed. But I'm suggesting it came from the knowledge of the descendants of the sons of Noah, and it was corrupted. Maybe also they remembered that Abraham had said that God would produce a lamb, and he did it in the case
of Isaac, and he did it in the case of his son. And as these ideas were corrupted, I'm suggesting to you that this corruption led to the similarity of what this man Davies records. Now, what about our position? We have to go back to the very basics. Blair said early in his lessons, based on what was written in Hebrews, that he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is the rewarder of them that diligently seek him. The claim that the Almighty makes is that he is creator. And therefore, as the creator of all that is in the earth, he had a plan and a purpose for this. And the plan and the purpose that he had from the beginning, after the slip, the fall, the condemnation of the first parents, was for redemption. And so this Jesus, of whom we have read,
we
have studied this week, and read these qualifications as to make him as an acceptable sacrifice of the human race, it was in the plan and purpose from the very beginning. Because we read that God's Son was sacrificed from the foundation of the earth in the plan and purpose of God. And because he is creator, and because he had a purpose, and because his son was an integral part of it, and because it was necessary for him to suffer, these are the reasons that the sacrifice of Jesus as a member of the human race is acceptable, whereas the others are copies and fraud and the evolution of the thinking of men. Sometimes I get ahead of my notes. Now, you remember Tom's talk the other night? He said in his talk that God also would reward those that were obedient to him by many blessings. He cited the case of what happened to the returnees from the nation of Babylon who had been taken there by Nebuchadnezzar and later returned under Ezra and Nehemiah and Zerubbabel. And in the first chapter of the book of Haggai, verses 10 and 11, they were told that because they had ceased in laboring for the Lord, that God would also withhold the rain and the dew so that they wouldn't harvest and the vines would not produce. Now, you see, this God, poor way of putting it, the God that we worship, not only has made provisions for the redemption of man, but he can involve himself with the natural forces of this creation to control them to bring about his desired wish and to be used in a way that will direct his people to be aware of his presence and their need of him. Don't you think that those people, pagans, who have developed these ideas would have, from their original parents having come from the sons of Noah, be totally aware of how God had intervened with the affairs of this world by the bringing of a devastating flood?
And therefore, they also would be aware in their blind way of worshiping that they would try to get, as this guy suggests, the cosmic arrangement in order. But God, the creator of the heavens and the earth, controls these things, as is in evidence in the matter of Haggai. And again, by these people of the ancient world making sacrifice to try and get these things in arrangement, it was simply as a result of their awareness that he was involved and could be involved in the physical phenomena of the world. Now, one of the points that I want to really emphasize here, if I can, this topic, as you can see, would demand a great deal more time than we've been able to give it. How we defense against this kind of an accusation, the following of the scriptures are just like other cults. The acid test, really, of the credibility of the order that we have been studying this week is this. Under the divine way that we follow, the book of instructions that we follow, it is the only book in the world that predicts the future. That's the critical test. None of these other cults, while they may have similarities to that which is taught in the scriptures, none of them lay any claim to be able to foretell the future. And why did I direct your attention to that seemingly unimportant thing in relation to why Moses was called and why he led the children of Israel out? Do you know that in his act, that was one of the first prophecies that was fulfilled in the scriptures? And that became the means by which the credibility of the Almighty was proven to those who were his followers. By being able to predict the future long before the event took place, and then when the event took place, it was fulfilled according to that which had been told of it. In this generation, we have volumes of evidence. You know, Peter witnessed the sacrifice of Christ. He heard him speak, and he saw his mighty works that was spoken of this morning. His credibility before men was proven in his signs and wonders that he performed. Peter witnessed these things. But he said, I give you an eyewitness account. But he said, that's fine. Eyewitnesses die. But he said, the more sure word of prophecy is the real anchor for our conviction and our absolute confidence in the things that are recorded in the scriptures, that what is done, as we have discussed this morning or this week, of the sacrifice of Christ being the will and purpose of God, the sureness that we have that what is contained in this book is established by the proving of the predictions that it has made coming to pass. When we go home, let us remember that the confidence that we have in this word, this Bible of ours, is so unshakable that nothing should ever happen to us in this life that would discourage us and deter us in our determination to serve the living God. He from the beginning had a plan. He created this earth for a purpose. He brought his son to this earth and allowed him to be sacrificed for a purpose. And the purpose was that out of this creation,
he may take some pleasure. And while we may seem in our minds as insignificant cogs in the overall plan, and we are, let us remember that by dedication and total commitment to God of our lives, that we, the elements of the dust, can give the Creator of the heavens and the earth some degree of pleasure. It's a thought that staggers us when we fully contemplate it. And so, in my crude and roundabout way, we've come to a point at this week's rehearsal of some of the things that are familiar to us all, to the point that we have absolute and sure confidence in the Scriptures, in the Word of God, in the sacrifice His Son has made, an absolute confidence that at the set time, God will indeed bring that time when there will be joy on the earth, goodwill among men, and glory and honor given by the people of this earth to the Creator and Sustainer of all life. I'm going to quit on that note. I would also like to take this opportunity of thanking the committee of this Bible school for this fine week they've provided for us all, and we've enjoyed it. We hope you'll come up and see us up north sometime.